This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Tom Schroeder. He's the author of a really great book called The Most Famous Writer Who Ever Lived, A True Story of My Family. And I should preface by saying he is not the most famous writer who ever lived. It's about your grandfather, who at one time was, in fact, perhaps the most famous writer in America. Well, he was among them, let's say.
Hardly that. He was famous, but that is an ironic title.
Yes.
And the very first sentence of the book is basically explains it, which is that when I was growing up, my mother told me that my grandfather, her father, had them absolutely convinced that he was the most famous writer who ever lived.
Well, in his imagination, and by his name, by the way, was McKinley Cantor. And I think, you know, a big part of this story is the ebb and flow of writers' currency and culture.
Absolutely. I when I sat down to write this, a lot of what I wanted to write about was the vicissitudes of literary fame and, you know, the yearning for it. My grandfather was in an interesting position because at one point he had attained, something like the pinnacle of literary fame. In 1956, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel Andersonville. And not only was that hugely critically praised, but it sat at number one on the bestseller list for close to a year. And not only that, he made tons and tons of money on it. So it was kind of like, as a writer myself, it was sort of like the ultimate fantasy.
And it is amazing. And of course, I loved reading about, I mean, you did a prodigious amount of research into his life. And we probably should talk about the way that you entered into that whole process. But the story of him growing up is almost like fiction itself. His life story is pretty incredible.
Yeah, and the way it happened was that as a teenager, he died in 1977 when I was 23 years old. And by that time, his literary fame had faded almost completely. And he lost the vast sums of money that he made. He kind of spent it all and hadn't invested and had put a mortgage on the beach house that he owned on Siesta Key in the Gulf Coast of Florida. And he died. He had also a long time drinking issue. And he died basically of complications of alcoholism, and he was broke. So I had always, and plus as a teenager, being skeptical and, you know, sort of cynical as so many are, I didn't really think much of his fame. I thought it was overblown. I thought he was a bit of a blowhard, although I always loved him. But that coupled with the fact that he became more and more politically reactionary, just as I was going in the opposite direction. So I kind of dismissed him and I didn't pay attention when my mother would tell me about his life and I didn't ask questions. And then, you know, years, decades after he died, when my mother died as well, I suddenly started getting really curious about it. I mean, here I am, a writer. I'd never credited my grandfather's influence with wanting to be a writer. And I just started suddenly realizing, why didn't I ask questions when I had the chance? And just as I started becoming really curious about it, everybody on the face of the earth who could have given me answers was gone. And then I remembered something. When we were kids, we would get these long letters from my grandfather, and they'd be really fabulous letters filled with all these details, sometimes, you know, talking over our heads as kids. And we would always joke that he wasn't really writing to us. He was writing to the Library of Congress, because after Andersonville, the Library of Congress, which doesn't usually collect the papers of writers, decided it wanted to collect the papers of, quote, a typical American author. and they decided my grandfather was it. So I would discover that in the Library of Congress, which happened to be only 25 miles, a short 35-minute metro ride from my home in Northern Virginia, right to the doorstep of the Library of Congress, and I would discover that they had in storage 158 boxes filled with 50,000 documents, all of or about my grandfather.
That is amazing, you know, because, and of course, I think that a lot of people today of your age and my age feel similarly about their relatives who are no longer with us. You know, that this sense that we just weren't interested when they were around, and they didn't work very hard to tell us about a lot of the things that happened to them. It was just life, you know, and we kind of didn't hear the stories in many cases. And then I think a lot of people share that sense of wanting to hear the stories, but by the time they're ready to hear them, no one's around to tell them.
Well, that's what makes the genealogical craze. You know, now they say that genealogical research is the second biggest American hobby after gardening, and the second most viewed variety of website after pornography. And that's why. But most people, when they get interested in their ancestors, they've got to dig through these musty records. And at best, even if they make some lucky finds, they're really just sort of deriving stick figures right of their ancestors. And here I had this opportunity to do this amazing three-dimensional portrait of my grandfather and to get to know him because of the nature of his letters and the documents in there, which were, you know, sort of written by a Pulitzer Prize winning author, after all. I was able to get to know him sort of better through this documentation than even some of his intimate friends knew him, because I had triangulated it from a whole bunch of different sources, not just, you know, one friendship. So that was really just an amazing experience. And of course, I didn't stop at the Library of Congress, but a lot of the things in there were leads that led me to other kinds of research, and even other caches of his papers that I discovered existed. So it was an amazing journey for me.
You may have said something about this in the book, but I think it got past me if you did. How long did it take you altogether to do the work? Because I have a mental picture of you in the Library of Congress. Yes. You know, you paint that picture very well.
Well, I spent months in the Library of Congress, but the whole process took me, the research and the writing together took about 2 years.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a long time. But I think that it's something that, you know, obviously, as you say, you have that special opportunity. Not only is all that material available, but you also do have memories that you can go back to you lived enough of your life when he was still alive to have some clear memories of him.
Oh, yeah. And he was a very significant figure in my life that, you know, until I was 14, we lived in New York. And we would, every winter, we would go down and spend our like Christmas vacation down there and stay at his house in Siesta Key, which just was fab. I mean, it was on 3.5 acres of beachfront jungle. And it was like a fantasy to go there. And his study filled with all these incredible artifacts of his career and his stints prominently as a correspondent in World War II, where he practically became a member of the 305th Bomb Group under General Curtis LeMay and actually flew combat missions and even against the Geneva Convention, fired the machine gun in the turret. So he had all this great World War II paraphernalia hanging from his walls, all his Saturday Evening Post covers of stories that were on the cover of the magazine, all this stuff about the Civil War and Indians. And it was just fabulous being there. And then when I was 14, we moved to Siesta Key ourselves. And you know, and I basically went to high school living in a house that was about a mile from his house. And we would see him all the time. So, you know, it was a very close relationship, even if, you know, I wasn't paying as much attention as I should have.
Did you ever see the Mad Men show? Did you ever watch that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So do you remember, I mean, there were things that struck me in a couple of episodes having grown up in that period, but you think about the little kids watching the parents having parties. And I kind of had that feeling about what it might have been like for you and your siblings to be around there, you know, when he was being himself. You know, they drank a lot. They kind of lived this larger than life life.
Oh, and he really did. And those parties that they had are such vivid memories for me. You know, they'd have all these, you know, I remember like my grandmother, like smelling of like gardenias and these little cigarillos that she learned to smoke in Spain. And my grandfather puffing on his pipe and all the cocktail glasses clinking and, you know, and he had quite a community of people, and he knew famous people. I mean, he was friends with Ernest Hemingway and the crime novelist John D. MacDonald. And there was a whole community of writers in Sarasota that he knew, writers and artists. My grandmother was a painter. And so they would have these very glamorous cocktail parties, unlike, you know, anything I've ever really done as an adult even. And he was an extremely social, and he was the type of guy who is like the center of attention in the life of the party. And his sort of addiction to that actually was kind of a problem for him. And, you know, and this culture, as you sort of mentioned, of the Mad Men culture of just where drinking was really part of the fabric of their existence. And he later, I discovered when I was doing my research, that he sort of late came to the understanding that alcohol was a problem for him. But he was really conflicted because he didn't feel he could be creative. He could have that creative energy if at the end of the day he couldn't unwind with, you know, a cocktail or five.
Right. Well, that was kind of the life that he built, kind of reflexively. And you can understand that. I think, you know, with imagining a writer, as you know well, I think having to churn out the amount of work that he did. I mean, he wrote a lot of books. Some of his books were,
I think, 45 books.
And of course, Andersonville and a couple more that were really long. And it's just an immense amount of labor on a daily basis to do that. You have to, you know, get up in the morning and put yourself down in front of what was then the typewriter and just plug away until you're done. And so it makes sense to me that he felt the way he did.
And you know, I came away, he really, reading his work, and I hadn't even read much of his work growing up, but reading it for this, I really came to, he really had a genius with words. I mean, just this incredible, powerful facility with words. And yet I came to understand that his greatest talent was that steel-buttedness, the ability to just sit there and work no matter what. And I came across one letter where he was describing finishing a book, crossing the Atlantic in a passenger ship during a hurricane. And he'd wake up at 4 a.m, go down to the bar before anybody was there, and sort of sit down at a table, and he'd be holding the typewriter down on the table with one hand while the glasses were like flying off the shelves and breaking all around him, and typing with the other. And I just think about how hard it is to write under the absolute most serene circumstances. And, you know, whenever I'm writing, you know, it's like anything, any distraction can be a temptation for me to stop. And I've always felt like writing was sort of like holding your hand over a candle. You know, it's just boring into your soul. And the pain is excruciating and you just want to stop. But ultimately, you know, until you type enough words that you can begin to shape them, you're nowhere. So I really had unbelievable admiration for this, his ability to sit there and focus on it. And of course, as a kid, that came about, you know, the way I encountered that as a kid was how, if he was working and we made any noise, he'd like hit the roof and the wrath of God would be upon us.
Yeah, I'm laughing because, you know, my father was a writer and I grew up with that whole idea of the door being, when the door is closed, you know, you're supposed to be seen and not heard. And because, you know, dad's
we're
in there.
Neither seen nor heard.
Right. Well, right. You know, dad's working, so shut up and go outside and play, you know.
It's like, right.
They were, you know, but you can now, you know, you kind of understand where that came from. Right. But let's go back a little bit to, I mean, I think I don't want to talk too much about his early life because that is so, you described it so beautifully. And I think readers should find it out for themselves, but just what drove him, you know, what drove him to, I mean, being a writer is not a normal occupation and it, you know, you could sort of try to figure out how he got to writing. I think you could probably say, yeah, you know, it might've been to some extent his mother who edited a newspaper in Iowa and was seemingly a pretty good writer herself.
I came across her work and again, I just recognized this facility with words, which, you know, my mother wrote a novel also, and my daughter had a play professionally produced. So there has to be some genetic predisposition happening there. But, you know, in terms of his motivation, I think it was, you know, as you said, without going too much into his background, which really was Susan Cheever reviewed this book, and her father, of course, was John Cheever. So she was like, I was really grateful that they chose her to review it. And when she was talking about that material that I uncovered, she said it was a biographical goldmine. And it really was. It was like I went into the Library of Congress wondering, how long is it going to take before I go through these files and I find something that's interesting? I was prepared to sit there for days before. And like the very first thing I looked at, the very first file I opened out of these, you know, thousands of files, and the very first document in that file was a letter that he'd written in April of 1945, reacting to the horror of being present around the time of the liberation of Buchenwald. And I, you know, which completely shocked me. I'd never heard that story. I had no idea that he was there. And then it was sort of like every single paper I touched was fascinating to me. So it really was an incredible goldmine. But anyway, back to the subject of his motivation, without giving too much away, his father, he hated his father. His father was a scoundrel. His father left his pregnant mother, pregnant with him, before he was even born, and didn't even talk to him until he was 7 years old, and was a problematic presence in my grandfather's life throughout until he died in the 50s. And so between that sort of repeated betrayal of his father and this passionate sort of adoration of his mother, who, you know, was this single mother with a scandalous sort of divorce in a small town, Iowa, which you can imagine what that must have been like. Anyway, she loved words and she loved stories, and she managed, because she was the daughter of a miller and the granddaughter of a miller, somebody in the town asked her to write a chapter in a historical book about Iowa, of the mills of Hamilton County, Iowa. And so she wrote this and it was published, and that like transformed her life. And because of that, she got hired to work on a newspaper. And then she later became the first female editor of a Iowa newspaper. And in fact, she gave my grandfather a job. She insisted that if she was going to come to work at this small town newspaper. She'd only do it if her son, my grandfather, could come along and work with her when he was like 19 years old. And she adored him, and she kept basically telling him he was a genius. And I think the combination of sort of compensating for this lack of a relationship or this horribly negative relationship with his father and being buoyed by this adoration of his very literary mother. And I think that created the conditions where he just sort of conceived that this was who he was going to be. He was going to be this great writer. And he suffered terribly. He wrote for years in extreme poverty. My mother was born into a household that they could barely feed her. And he had to do things, for instance, like he had to ignore a mouthful of horrible cavities and terrible pain from his cavities because he couldn't afford to go to a dentist. And he would do things like he would soak cotton in some kind of mixture and sort of jam them into the holes in his teeth and sit in the bathroom with his head between his legs to try to dull the pain. So he withstood all that. And I always kind of thought, you know, how could he have let his family suffer from being so poor when you know, that hubris of saying, oh, I'm going to be a great writer someday, when it took years and years for him to actually succeed. And I was thinking, how could anybody ever have done that? Why didn't he go out and get a real job? And then as I was reading through his letters, I saw he really couldn't. This was in the middle of the Depression. He couldn't get any work, and he tried. So that was something that I learned about him that I hadn't known. And I had kind of looked sort of askance at the fact that he would sort of, you know, sort of let what I sort of presumed was his vanity keep him at it when it wasn't producing any income.
Yeah, it is. I visualized that period through your storytelling, and I thought, you know, it was just amazing what people did go through. But it is kind of also, even though it was the thing that he was able to do, the fact that he was relentless and wouldn't quit is that, you know, when people talk about what does it take to succeed in anything, you know, one of the things, the one of the lessons is, you know, you just have to keep on doing it. You can't quit. You have to not give up when you, and he got rejected how many times?
I have a book. I found on my shelves a cloth bound book where he had written on these tiny lines every submission that he had ever made to a magazine or a publisher, and next to it, for like the first 100 pages, everyone said rejected. It was really an amazing thing to look at that and see how many rejections he got. And, you know, the courage and self-belief that took was one of the ways that I really grew to admire him through this journey of what I learned about him.
Do you think, you know, that by the same token, that is what sowed the seeds for him to not be able to continue after that great period of, you know, this period of fantastic success? It almost, you know, because of that self-belief and then actually being successful, made it impossible for him to be able to be flexible and change who he was to, you know, and be, you know, kind of keep on growing as a writer.
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely true, because, you know, he was sort of successful against all odds and against, you know, I'm sure everybody was telling him that, you know, he had no, you know, he's crazy to keep at it. But because he was so successful, he thought, why should I trust anybody else's opinion but my own? And he became very closed off. He wouldn't work with that. I mean, he wouldn't really let editors, he didn't trust editors to tell him anything. And who could blame him? He reached these unbelievable heights of success. I mean, he not only had this novel Andersonville, but He wrote a novel called Glory for Me that was became the movie The Best Years of Our Lives, which was won 7 Academy Awards. And at the time it was made, it was the highest grossing movie since Gone with the Wind. So he just had these fabulous successes. And right at that period of time in American history, when a successful writer was a huge celebrity, I mean, you know, this was the period of Faulkner and Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And he was, you know, in fact, he was the people that preceded and followed him for the Pulitzer were Faulkner and Hemingway.
That's right. No, that's true. The writers at that time were kind of not only literary figures, but they were also cultural figures. You know, I'm thinking about Norman Mailer and, you know, and Faulkner too. I mean, you know, all and Hemingway, thinking about how impactful they were on popular culture, you know, that they're probably, they were like rock stars in a certain way.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the coolest things I found was a double page magazine spread ad of, for Lord Calvert whiskey called the Man of Distinction. My grandfather was the Man of Distinction and he's pictured there in some swank Manhattan hotel room with, you know, a pipe in one hand and the glass of the Lord Calvert in the other, and all his sort of writing and publishing cronies surrounding him, laughing at this obvious, you know, at what I knew to be clearly it's some dirty joke he was telling, because he loved to tell dirty jokes. And it was like, you know, that Tom Wolfe thing, Masters of the Universe. It was like you look at that picture and you think he was absolutely a master of the universe at that moment. And knowing what I know and what I learned, the irony of it was that was probably the moment of his peak fame.
Right.
And I just looked at that picture and I thought, I wonder what he would have thought if he knew that from that moment on, the moment that they snapped that picture on, basically it was a fairly steady decline and then a precipitous decline. And, you know, it wasn't that he quit writing at all. He continued to write until he couldn't physically do it anymore, until he was like sick and almost dying. It's just that, and he stuck to the kind of, in fact, he kind of doubled down on some of the things in his writing that were beginning to be perceived as passé and that were beginning to be a harder sell. And so, you know, he continued to get some really big advances after Andersonville, but they didn't pay out. And the publishers like took a bath on it. So he started having to go to lower level publishers with smaller and smaller advances. And in the end, and I didn't know this either, but I discovered at the end of his life, he even did a hired biography to write the biography of some rich insurance agent, insurance executive, which I didn't know. And he even said at one point that he would never be a ghostwriter. So it was kind of sad to see that.
But he was at that point, he was at that point fairly desperate for money. So
yeah, you know, and when he started getting rejections, he decided it was because publishers were prejudiced against him because his books hadn't panned out recently. So he wrote what he considered to be sort of contemptuously a contemporary novel and submitted it under a pseudonym to see if he could, you know, thinking that his talent was still there and that would speak for itself. But of course, nobody bought it.
Do you think that, it's sort of funny because his style of writing did date fairly quickly. And it seems that maybe he was kind of the last writer of his era in a way. I mean, I think Andersonville may have been maybe the culmination of his work, but it just feels like the culture changed more quickly than he did. And he was stuck in that kind of 30s, 40s, 50s modality, and the culture was moving into this other place. Do you think that's right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And he the way he reacted to that was by hating the popular culture of the 60s and 70s and being kind of, obnoxious about it. you know, and it was because, you know, it had sort of rejected him. So he was rejecting it in spades. You know, I think that, it's hard to imagine a 350,000 word book with a bunch of sort of authentic, but very hard to read Civil War era dialect being and vocabulary from that period that was obsolete, you know, was archaic already when he wrote it. But that's what he did for Andersonville. And it's hard to imagine that kind of book being a number one bestseller these days.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I mean, I've thought about this having, you know, I've read through the bestseller lists from probably about, you know, the earliest ones that you can find, which are early 1900s. And it is shocking how many books on those bestseller lists have literally disappeared. And then you go and you think, well, maybe, you know, maybe one of these should be brought back, and you go read it and you realize, no, this book does not stand up to a modern reader. It just won't work.
I went back and read some of his early novels before he began thinking of himself as this sort of historic literary Library of Congress preserved, figure. And they held up better. He wrote a book called Long Remember. That was his first big best-selling book. In 1934, about civilians who got caught in the Battle of Gettysburg. And that's still like a real page turner now. I mean, it's almost more stripped down and plain language. It sort of reads more like a Hemingway novel than his later novels did. And it really holds up pretty well. And even his very first novel, which was about a young writer who's trying to make it in Chicago, just like he did, who winds up sort of in this rooming house where there's this big time gangster sort of laying low and trying to hide because everybody's out to kill him. And he gets sort of involved with this gangster. And it's sort of a terrific story and beautifully written and much more sort of spare and modern seeming than the works he's best remembered for.
You think that there's a chance that that they may be, you know, those books could come back? I mean, I think Andersonville is still in print and still read.
The same publisher that published me, the paperback arm, just brought out a new edition of Andersonville, which actually is selling modestly well. So yes, and there is some interest in this, and he had a backlist of things, and somebody sort of purchased those to bring them out as ebooks. I think that there is that possibility. I gave a book talk recently, and I couldn't believe it. This guy in his 20s came up to me and said he was from Chicago. And he had happened across Diversity, and he just loved it. And that's why he had come to the talk.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Diversity is the Chicago book. The gangster book.
Well, you know, I certainly remember reading Andersonville, when I was probably, I must have been 12 or 13. I was devouring Civil War books at that point. I loved long books, because when you get lost in a novel, it's one of the best feelings in the world.
Absolutely.
And I loved that book, even though I remember being told by the librarian that it was probably too old for me, and there were things in that book that would be fairly brutal. Any kid's going to dismiss anybody telling them they can't read something.
But in fact, it makes them want to read it more.
Exactly. But I was interested that the inspiration for that you felt, and I think probably is correct, that came from what you mentioned earlier, that he had been in Germany and had witnessed at least the early stages of the liberation of Buchenwald concentration camp.
Right. And in fact, he said that he was in that camp, and the piles of bodies were still there. And in fact, a lot of the prisoners had been so sick and so malnourished that when they ate the food that the liberators were bringing in, it killed them.
Basically. Right. They died. Now, I know that was one of the most horrible things you can imagine, surviving Buchenwald and then dying on liberation.
Yes. And so there was the smell of death and decaying bodies and vomit, both from the prisoners who couldn't handle the food and the visitors who couldn't handle what they were seeing. And it was surrounded by pine forest. So that mixture of scent, of that strong scent of pine, and then the sense of death and vomit and decay. And he realized, suddenly it struck him, that those were probably the exact smells that you would have smelled at Andersonville, which was also surrounded by pine and also had, these 13 to 15,000 people died there in a space of months. And so that was the trigger. I mean, he'd said elsewhere that he had spent 20 years researching it, which is believable considering the unbelievable detail in there. But I also discovered, which I had no idea of, that his great-grandfather and his great-grandfather's brothers all were Union soldiers. And one of them, his great-grandfather, fought in the Indian Wars in the West, and the rest of them all fought in the Civil War. And one of them, it turns out, I found in records at the National Archives, what had actually been a Southern prisoner of war.
Yeah.
So clearly he knew about that, and that probably had provoked his interest in it really early on.
So I know we're sort of nearing the end point here, but I wanted to ask you, since you talk a lot in this book, I mean, a lot of this book is about you as a writer and about your work and the struggle, the difficulty and the painfulness of writing, which you present pretty vividly. So I have to ask, what is, what's going to be your next project? Are you going to, you've got something else that you're working on?
Well, I there are a few things I'm thinking about, but I have, I hold on a second. Sorry about that. Anyway, yes, I have several things in mind. And, one thing that's going on is that I actually did serve as ghostwriter on a book, for a guy named Rob O'Neill, who was the Navy SEAL Team 6 guy who put two bullets in Bin Laden's forehead, and his amazing career. And, that's all sort of awaiting. It's all sitting there in the Department of Defense as it's trying to get cleared. But that'll be coming out sometime next year, early next year, I hope.
Oh, that's a fantastic story.
Oh, really? He's an amazing guy. It was just a great experience working with him. And, and he had, it wasn't just about the Bin Laden mission. It was about his whole, he basically had 12 years of continuous combat, which, that's an incredibly long time to be going out for over 400 combat missions. That was the whole Navy SEAL team and the training for that, and who these guys are and what they went through is just an amazing story.
Well, so even though it's a struggle, you are lucky to have the opportunity to be a writer, I think.
Believe me, I haven't had anywhere near the success that my grandfather's had. And I sort of was coming to grips with that, sort of realizing exactly how successful he was. But on the other hand, I've been able to make a living as a writer, since I was in my early 20s. And I've had the privilege of having 5 books published, and, now I'm sort of being able to continue on and help other people with their books. So, I couldn't ask for anything more. And I also saw that the kind of success my grandfather had in the end, it didn't, didn't work out that great for him towards the end of his life. So, you know, that kind of fame is that really isn't the goal. The goal is to be able to do it, to be able to do the work. And I'm incredibly grateful that I have been.
Well, it's, you know, maybe in the end, you get to have your grandfather's life as a kind of bank of information to help you live your own life.
Absolutely. And it really has. And I realized doing this that I actually took a lot more of it in than I realized. And it actually helped me form my attitudes, both about writing and sort of in opposition to what he did, about sort of being more sort of investment and oriented and more conservative in my spending, because I saw what happened to him. And in the back of my mind, that was always this sort of like horror that I was trying to avoid.
Well, I hope that you can continue to avoid that and not end up like he did. I trust that you'll be able to do it.
Oh, I know. But of course, you know, there is that end none of us can avoid.
That is true. But we want to put that off as long as possible also.
Sure do.
Well, thanks so much, Tom, for talking to me. This is, you know, it's been really fun. And I really loved this book. So I hope it turns out to be a wildly successful book. Maybe it'll be your bestseller. But
thanks so much.
All right. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Tom Schroeder about The Most Famous Writer Who Ever Lived, A True Story of My Family.